All right, ladies and gentlemen, it is 3:15. I am the moderator. I am Perry Marshall from Chicago. We are in for a good time because I just found out that all three of these amigos are in the AI and Faith group. So they have conspired together to coordinate their efforts and steer this conversation in a particular way. From the University of Scranton, Pennsylvania, we have Cyrus P. Olson. And I believe if your vision comes true, all that office problem stuff will just go away.
Sure,
yeah, right?
Sure.
Yeah. All right, well, without further ado, Cyrus Olson, you're up.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you for the time. And Thomas, Mark, and I actually have co-published together on compassionate care and AI. So we're here together continuing that work ostensibly on compassionate care and how we might think about integrating AI and faith into healthcare and medicine. And I also have an affiliation with Harvard Medical School through a stroke lab and a Templeton grant, which I'll talk about shortly in the talk here. Okay, so that's my code for Scranton, if you need to get it from the QR code there for you. And this is some art generated by DALL-E that alludes to the research on ancestral and spiritual factors in Uganda that we integrate into our work at the stroke lab in Harvard. So let's just begin here, though, with since diversity is a theme of the conference, right, and thinking about participation in science and where we might land for ourselves, right? Scientists are that dark box in the back corner there. This is supposed to be three-dimensional, and that's the source for you there, the research. But where it is that people land with respect to public communication of science, knowledge, and capacity. And I think we're here together to learn from one another about where we might contribute better to a common conversation and bring ourselves up to speed in areas that we don't otherwise specialize in and collaborate so that maybe the public communication of science is clearer and trust is built in communities, right? So it's a problem that we have in universities. Now I think you know from the publications and news about wavering trust in university life. What's it for? What's it about? Can we be better collaborators together? And that's part of what Thomas, Mark, myself, and others are engaged in here, okay? So, in the title for the talk, one of the things I proposed, as you can see at the very bottom there, is rhetorical listening. So if anybody knows this from the tradition of, it's used in queer theory, feminist theory, and really rhetoric studies, right? The idea that in terms of preparing yourself for rhetorical flourish, that in fact maybe the first component of the five classical components of rhetoric would be to listen for invention, right? So the first component of rhetoric is to invent your category, to be creative and think about your audience. But that's often just in communication, but not listening. So can we have a disposition that's more oriented towards listening, receptivity in body and self, and so that we actually are attending to the other clearly in the process of gathering information and communicating? And you know, in terms of the patient-provider or patient-physician relationship, they don't have time to listen, right? We heard in the last big panel about efficiency, right? Really a cult of efficiency that dominates our world today. And physicians are paid upon how quickly they can get through patients usually, right? So do you have time in the healthcare industry to attend to listening? That would be a challenge that maybe something like integration of AI might help with, right? That's the idea we're gonna try to look at a little bit here. Though a colleague of ours from AI and Faith recently published this in Nature, that AI returns gibberish when trained on generated data. So how do you get AI continue to be trained or fine-tuned in such a way that it's not just gonna continue to churn out gibberish, but might actually be trained and tuned and fine-tuned more directly. That's one of our concerns here, okay? And then keeping our focus, if we can, on diversity, and I have a nod to Templeton there that's funding some of this research that I'm involved in. Part of the context for us, though, is AI 3.0, okay? We heard about Web 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0 in one of the previous talks. In this case, this is AI 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0. If you want the source, it's there. This is from the three epochs of artificial intelligence in healthcare. And you can see there at 3.0, we're fairly new, right? 2018 to the present. And trying to figure out the weaknesses and strengths that we have available to us as a consequence of applying large language models in healthcare models and in care. Radiology is probably the highest place, the place where you find the most patents and the most use of late because of the integration of images and its capacity to do really well in terms of crunching accuracy about a diagnosis, okay? So the aim really is, in this context, to think about diagnostics, right? And how it is that AI can be built into the diagnostic pathway, inclusive of something like listening to the patient and compassionate care. Is that possible, right? Okay. I'll give you an example from our lab at Harvard. So this is a social bit that's actually in use. It's a wearable sensor. And they have a patent for this, or working on a patent for this, but they have permissions to do this work. And what it does is it listens for stroke patients who might have aphasia or other difficulties with speech, but it gets an auditory signature of the person without language. So it gets a register of the voice and the ambient structure, ambient background. It can even tell if they're watching TV rather than talking to a person. It's a way of listening with technology, right? And AI is listening. There's an algorithm here, a machine learning algorithm in use, to find out how to deal with, you might have seen the epidemic of loneliness that the Surgeon General talked about, right? That how do you deal with loneliness and isolation for stroke patients by monitoring the degree to which they're engaging with others, which helps their neuroplasticity, right? They can actually recover better if they interact more, right? And are less isolated. So this is in use, it's being studied by the lab at Harvard, the DeHaan lab, who's the final name there, Amar DeHaan. Listed on there. That's the lab to which I belong right now, and that we're doing social network analytics in relation to stroke care. So this is also about mapping your relationships in terms of who it is that you interact with and how that affects your health. So maybe there's a way we can think about social bits in a larger context of rhetorical listening, right? Without it being without succumbing too readily to surveillance society and the problems that we have with that, right? Okay. So I'll just briefly talk about our work in Uganda. So we try to extend the stroke care lab work into Uganda, which is what our Templeton grant is for, which you'll see at the end of the project here. And it's about health-seeking behavior in the first prong of our work, right? In terms of what Anthony Balcom calls the socio-spiritual matrix of patients, right? So we know that we navigate health differently in different contexts, right? And how it is that you get care changes in terms of where you live, who you talk to, how you get to help if you need it. And in Uganda in particular, there's a whole context of you can consult herbalists before you go to a physician, if ever you see a physician, or maybe you'll go to a traditional healer of a certain kind, or a traditional birth attendant, or maybe in the case of mental health cases, never see a doctor for 8 to 10 years, depending upon how you navigate the system of care, right? So what we're trying to study is in what ways did the spirituality and the beliefs of Ugandans, in our case, we're mostly studying communities that are influenced by Christianity, though you could integrate Islam and other traditional religions into this. But we know that in Uganda, for example, there's a lot of still remaining indigenous traditions that are intermixed with the Christian inheritance there. Okay, so that's part of our project, which I'll talk more about. So what we're doing and what we have done already is co-created a questionnaire with 4 sections, and this is a concept map here you have on the left that we've made about those relationships. It's like a graph model, okay? So what we're doing is we're trying to understand based upon identity, nature, health, and spirits, so relationship to living folks and the living dead, as they say, the one's ancestors and spirits, and how that influences the path that one takes for seeking health. Okay. And this is a common way that amongst the Baganda and the central region of Uganda talk about their own health, that it's really about a life force, right? Okay, that can either be diminished or can flourish. And what you do impacts that, okay? How you navigate your health impacts the life force that you possess. Okay. This is a bit of a closer up version of that, if you can see it at all. And what we're trying to do and thinking about together is how to integrate, in this case, knowledge graphs and vector databases, okay? So we've heard about RAG, and there's also graph RAG, right? So there's retrieval augmented generation, but with graphs instead. So graphs you see there on the left, one company is Neo4j you can use, right, and their cipher language, but a knowledge graph is more about those nodes and edges and how you can conceive of relationships conceptually, right, and how they operate. And so you could put a patient there in the middle and who they go see with a line and in what way they get there, right? Whereas the vector database is a bit more about the math, about how distant someone is from something else, right, in your database, okay? I don't know if you know the character from Despicable Me, Vector. He has both magnitude and direction, right? So I don't know if anybody in Pixar, they probably had that in mind when they were thinking about this. So Pixar uses vector databases, right? So vector, you have to keep vector in mind when you think about vector databases, right? But it's a way of calculating proximity, right, in relationships. So a way to combine these, right, is to have multiple layers to your development of your large language model. The large language model is a base, right, from a foundation model, as we've heard. Right, but then integrating that with knowledge graphs and graph RAG, where you can have contextual knowledge and knowledge that's specific to a domain. In this case, let's say stroke care or public health, if you're engaged in that in a particular way, so that you can get more accurate feedback loops into your system and avoid some of those hallucinations that we've been talking about. Okay, this is just a way to imagine that from DALL-E with a little social bit that might be augmented and accented such that it's possible to conceive of compassionate care being a component of what's read out by a physician? Is it possible that they could have information about your own religious tradition, your own needs as a patient, coming from your own recorded or curated rag, as it were, so that you can feed that into the system and that the physician and healthcare professional can be cognizant of and learn from and listen to the patient and their traditions and from where they're coming, right? And maybe it's a way that they could have a read off of that in the future, okay? So there's that magnitude and direction from vector databases and vector representations, if you don't know this. But it's a common component of the way that AI is worked out today, right? And it will make sense of why I used that cube in the beginning, right? Or a hypercube, you could think of, right? Where is it in that cube that you could have a matrix that's made three-dimensional and see the relationships among folks that land within that? So if we think now about vectors with respect to text, video, and audio, and build a vector database in that context, utilizing multimodal generative AI, precision health becomes more possible, right? Okay, we already have precision health. We already have hyper-personalized healthcare being provided by certain companies, right? And it's continuing to be funded and advanced as we speak, right? But is there a way that we could include not simply the usual diagnostics and tests that can come from medical imagery and medical imaging, but also from one's own faith tradition and life and diversity, okay? This is a little bit more on vector databases and what's called approximate nearest neighbor, ANN there, which is what you're trying to do with vectors, right? You're trying to figure out with clusters, that's what that bottom right quadrant there is about with the circles, is trying to figure out when you're talking about magnitude and distance, right? How is it that you can create relationships that are clustered together that you can know about so that you might have a sense of where maybe common patients come together? We've been talking about bias a bit today, right? It's a way of, I guess, combining a physician's or a healthcare worker's sense of the kind of people that they read on average, right? And integrating a bit more information so that not too much bias sneaks in. And here I'm thinking of my friends who are ER physicians who work with people who might have difficulties with pain medications and come in and say, try to look like they're clever about seeking new ways to access, some new drug that they really know about, but they're trying to act ignorant about, right? So physicians can smell this quickly if they're dealing with somebody, right? They know, but is there a way that they could mitigate that bias maybe with some of the clustering that comes from combining this kind of information that's, again, more inclusive of other kinds of traditions and behaviors that include religious faith, okay? So this is what's why you see here for me, that I had integrated some brains here on the map here from DALI with respect to health-seeking behavior, some of those graph models put together, right? And trying to then be respectful of the degree to which in a place like Uganda and the dearth of information we have from sub-Saharan Africa, how we might build models that are enriched by those local communities, right? And might change our own sense of religious faith and practice. That allusion to the motorcycle down there is, if you don't know, that's motorcycle accidents have outstripped infectious diseases in places like Uganda in terms of the most dangerous, difficult things people live with. So, but here's a way to think further about this with respect to learning, okay, and rhetorical listening. So this is coming from using thinking about learning environments and personalization. Okay, it's really complex, so I don't mean to confuse you, but just to give you a sense of how you might build competencies for physicians and even in the healthcare training sequence. So if we're thinking about medical students, they do go through contexts where they have to learn in mock interviews and mock patients, like how to handle difficulties. But is there a way that maybe they could practice more readily with AI and build their competencies and build their skill taxonomy? And also then for us, enrich a sense of the ways that they might be helped by conversation with people outside their domain. And this then, to return to the many faces of participation in science, might assist the collaboration and help us pull that scientist block further into the public conversation and build that trust that's necessary, right? One of the problems with AI and with specialty in general is that people don't trust those specialists, right? And it sort of seems like they're speaking their own language that can't be shared with the world. So hopefully this kind of thing can do that work for us. If you're interested, I've learned a lot from this podcast, if you haven't had a chance to listen to it, Catalog and Cocktails. They have a lot on graph rags and vector databases that might be helpful for you. So just to share in terms of the world of sort of free, open, online education, this is one thing you might utilize for yourselves, okay? And I've for transparency's sake, I learned from this podcast recently about this journal that I didn't know about, of biomedical semantics, which is quite fascinating, right? Where they've really been working out some of these complications about how to integrate different layers in terms of the development of AI and machine learning in general with rich knowledge graphs, right? So this is a way of conceiving of different ways of representing knowledge and relationships such that it becomes complex enough and also honed enough that it's specific to a domain and useful to those use cases. Okay. So again, for specific cases such as stroke care, for example. Okay. And I'd like to say just in relation to this, what this particular case study does well, or this piece of research, is it talks about what's called FAIR guiding principles. I don't know if you've heard of these, but findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable, which are now in use for funding agencies, whether it's the US government or the Templeton World Charity Foundation. We had to say that the stuff we will publish is open source, so that people have access to the data behind it. They can vet it themselves. They can see how repeatable the science is, right, as a way of building, again, the trust in the community using those FAIR principles with respect to how data is managed and used in the research process. So Lubaga Hospital is a hospital that we work with in Kampala, in the central city of Kampala, biggest city in Uganda, one of the largest in Africa. And thinking about how it is that we can be respectful of the fact that people do still believe that there is the living dead, right, to whom they speak, to whom they relate, and who must be consulted to build consensus for how it is that I'm supposed to seek my care and my health, right? And to take this seriously, right, and to integrate that into what we're doing is we're building with them a version of what's used out of Harvard, which is called PersNet, a personal network survey for stroke patients. So who do you see and who do you seek help from within your network? And is there a way we can make that more expansive and richer that includes even people's orientation to nature, people's orientation to their spiritual traditions, all of which are integrated in a place like Uganda, right? Okay. We have a lot of prejudices in the West against those things, which we're trying to overcome and build bridges and relationships with folks in that context so that, in fact, the PersNet that's used in Cambridge can be sensitized to sub-Saharan Africa and used well there, and is sensitized by locals, right, who've done that work. Right? Okay. So this is our project and a little film I made recently from the footage from Uganda and the four hospitals that we're working with, if you want to take a look at it further. And the allusions in the title are to some work from Charles Taylor, if you know the philosopher Charles Taylor, about buffering and porosity in the modern self and how it is that we're sort of protected from outside influence. But if you have any sense of spirituality, you already have some kind of porous self where something's coming in, right? And you're being influenced by something. But the question is what and in what ways? So there are rich ways I think we can continue to collaborate together in this kind of space. And that's what Mark, Thomas, and I hope for in our collaborations and our work together. So thank you. I'll end there and we'll have questions later as time goes forward. So appreciate you.
Don't everybody speak at once.
Are there other problems these approaches could be applied to, such as medication compliance by patients?
Yeah, I mean, you know, now there's social prescribing, right? Which is, I guess, more common in the UK and Canada. Instead of giving somebody a prescription for medicine, you have to go out and see people, right? Okay. So the degree to which you're isolated might, you know, how do you gauge that? How do you know that? There could be a case for that, right? How isolated is a patient are you? How many people do you actually see on a daily basis? Now, it may be the case that those people you see are rich in social interaction, so you have to be careful, right? So it has to be sensitive enough to get the degree to which those relationships are richly constituted, right? But social prescribing might be one of those, but certainly many other case studies where this could be beneficial. Many people go to see a doctor not because they need help, because they just want to see somebody and talk, right? So physicians, especially in emergency rooms, become simply de facto psychologists, right? And so any way to mitigate that and help them and offload that burden, which those physicians don't need to be dealing with, right? They're there for really difficult cases like, you know, bringing somebody back to life when they're dead from a heart attack, right? Not necessarily for psychological assistance. And they're not prepared for that. They're not trained for that, right? So, but I do think it's in relation to that, the reference to medical students, to sensitize people being trained in medicine out of the simple, like, efficiency model, diagnostics with imagery, and the patient isn't all that important, right? I'm just a diagnostician for a body that's come to see me like a mechanic versus there's actually some compassionate care here that's possible. So I think there's some potential for training up a new generation of physicians and healthcare workers who are much more attentive to that. But they need practice and low stakes practice. So maybe playing with AI might help. Okay, we have two great other presentations, so thank you. If you need me, I think you have some of the QR codes, or you can find me after and we can talk more.
We've got 10 minutes. Tell us more about your Uganda project. How did that start? How many times have you been there?
I've lost count of the number of times I've been there now. So it started for me because I was invited to start a global immersion course with students at the University of Scranton. So a colleague of mine already had relationships, and he said, you might be fun to travel with and pass on this tradition to, so why don't you come see how this goes? So that's how it began for me. And then people there started to ask me to get involved in herbal medicine and other research projects, which then dovetailed into this. And I got a call from a friend at Harvard who said, we're trying to extend to Zambia, but I know you know Uganda well. Could it work there? And it sort of spun out from there after a two-year dance with Templeton. So and worked out. So, but the project there is really, they were concerned, they wanted to diversify their social network analyses from Cambridge, which is sort of a limited data set, and see if what they were finding there would work and is applicable in a place like Uganda, where actually people are much less isolated on average, right? Okay, and so just life is teeming with many more bodies and people, and yet there are modern dynamics that are really impacting those relationships, right? From unemployment to disease rates and boda-boda accidents and so forth. So is the idea of repeatable, valid science in a place like the clinical labs in Cambridge viable in Kampala and in the rural places of Uganda that we work? Yes or no? And so that's kind of the test case. But also to add then spirituality, because just to give you an example, I've gone on rounds for clinical neurology now at the Brigham. And they don't usually ask questions about one's orientation for spirituality with respect to what's going on in their health. But since I was there and shadowing, we brought this up. One woman said during COVID she was further isolated, could no longer sing in her church choir. And so we talked about, like, what do you do? Who do you talk to? And she said, well, I pray to God a lot. So God is in my social network. Yeah, but that's not modeled on average in any kind of healthcare modeling, right? So, what's the magnitude and distance from God in this case, right? So, trying to find a way to be inclusive even of spiritual traditions in the kind of measuring that they do for social networks is part of the project, and to do that in a place like Uganda. And then bounce it back to Cambridge, right? So it's reciprocal in that sense.
What was the most unexpected, totally surprising thing about Uganda or the project there?
So we were expecting, because it's a more communal collective space on average, to see different sort of measures of isolation and loneliness that arise, and belonging, sense of to whom one belongs. But we weren't aware of the way that certain communities were refugee communities by historical circumstance, and some were heavily and deeply embedded communities. We had it reversed. So I assumed that the people in the far rural place where the gorilla are preserved in the Bwindi near the Congo and Rwanda would have been much more richly indigenous. And they're not. There's a few, but they were kicked out of the forest with whom we work, the Batwa, or if you know the Twa from the Congo and all over that region. The pygmies from the rainforest, because they were forest dwellers, right? But they had no rights and were kicked out of the forest. And they're the only remaining indigenous groups who are basically losing their language and no longer have any land or culture, right? Except what's preserved in minor settlements. Everybody else is a refugee from somewhere else who lives in those areas, right? And so the people who are really embedded are the ones near Kampala in the Buganda region, who then talk about their family down to the seventh generation, right? And further, right? So that when they start telling you about their family history, it just is, and their land means their land, right? The idea that there still is the tradition that you would bury the umbilical cord in the land because you're directly connected to the soil, right? So my colleague from Notre Dame, Emmanuel Katangale, who is Ugandan, talks about that you belong to the earth, right? Like Laudato Si and Pope Francis, right? If you belong to the earth, then you'll care for the earth, right? And so that deep connection between spirituality, one's being embedded umbilical cord-wise in the earth, and that's connected to God and spirituality in a rich way. We expected to find more in the rural areas, but those areas are often newly occupied, unlike the places like around Kampala, which are very, very still ancestral lands, right? So you'll find more of the ancestral stuff in there than you will in Southwest. So that was counterintuitive for us. So
did that generalize to any particular way that medicine or medical outcomes are different? Therefore, like, does it carry over?
We don't know yet. So I was just listening to somebody who says, with respect to data, truth before meaning. So really good data, really good analysis before you start making claims. So I'll be careful there. So,
okay.
Thank you.
Well, any more?
Yeah, it looks like we have 5 minutes, right?
Yes,
okay.
We do.
Thomas.
I mean, not to hog the privilege of talking, but the social bit, I'm interested whether the team has been talking with policy people or legal people at Berkman Klein or other people who look at that and think, data privacy, is this going to be, a grandkid wanting their parent to wear it, and do they have access to the data, and how some of those ethical issues that I know have cropped up with digital devices, medical devices. So just interested who,
They're starting their first trials in homes. So it's mainly been in the hospital. So they monitor it from the hospital, and they took out video. People did not want video, as you might imagine. So. And then, of course, it's further protected by the fact that it doesn't track, it doesn't do any language processing. It's simply ambient noise, right? So, and doing a register there. So it's not collecting any information that would be identifiable by words or word patterns, but it does have a register that's identifiable from the machine learning, right? But it's also not very widely trained. I talked to them about that too. It's a fairly small collection. So they've gotten permission to use it under certain conditions outside of the clinic. So they're doing that. Because of those ways that they designed the machine learning and then took out video and took out some of the other components, that they've been protected in terms of privacy, right? So that is a major concern for my own argument of rhetorical listening and natural language processing and like using LangChain or something with respect to streams of words is how much that might be a problem for us. But if it was something that I was willing to curate myself and bring on a wearable, and let's say I had a stroke, or if I had a condition, heart attack or something, where my friend is a cardiologist in the ER and I can't speak, that maybe still they could, for my own permissions, have given consent of some kind legally, such that they can access that even under conditions of unconsciousness and care, right? So, but it's a complicated legal soup, to be sure. But on par with something like a will, right? You would imagine.
Or
so.
Medical alert bracelet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but I imagine that's something we could do. So.
Give Cyrus a hand.
Thank you.